kind of held non-defense spending and defense spending kind of in line. If you increased one, the other increased. So if you wanted money for education or schools, you had to increase defense spending. That ends as of this year. So next year, we have a real opportunity to go in and make some serious cuts on defense so we can trim it and right-size it. And that's going to be a major goal of many of us in Congress.
And last 10 seconds. Richard Neal just prevailed, chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, over Alex Morse in Western Mass. It was described as a fiercely homophobic campaign. Your thoughts?
It was. You know, whoever in their party, the Massachusetts party, convinced of College of Democrats to try to do a smear campaign should be kicked out of office. There's no accounting for that in politics. It shouldn't be for either party, and certainly Democrats should have a higher standard.
Congressman Mark Pocan, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KABU Evening News, three members of the Portland Police Citizen Review Committee resign, new records are released of Rochester police asphyxiating a black man to death after putting him in a hood, and President Trump moves to have Portland and other liberal cities named anarchist jurisdictions. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, September 3rd, 2020. KABU is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. Three members of Portland's 11-person Citizen Review Committee resigned Wednesday, citing failures in the city's management of police accountability. The CRC serves as a voluntary advisory board to the Independent Police Review, the city agency responsible for investigating police-related complaints. The resignations came within 24 hours of each other, with two directly citing last weekend's conflict between downtown protesters and armed Trump supporters as a final straw. Saturday evening, a caravan of pro-Trump supporters in vehicles stormed downtown Portland, disrupting traffic patterns and aggressively confronting protesters who had gathered there with little to no police intervention. Committee member Adam Green stated in his resignation letter, quote, "The events of the last weekend were a tipping point for me, a failed system with failed leadership. I can no longer support this system in any way." Hillary Hawk was a member of the CRC for 2 years. She also expressed dissatisfaction regarding local governing forces providing fair police accountability. Hawk recalled a 2018 jaywalking incident where escalated police force was excused by Mayor Ted Wheeler, even though the committee determined the excessive force deserved disciplinary action. The third CRC member to resign is Carol Johnson, who is also the Director of Civil Rights at Oregon Labor and Industries. Johnson did not give details as to why she decided to resign. Candace Avalos is the current chair of the CRC. She alleges that the independent police review has stopped recruiting for the oversight board, leaving the committee short-handed at an unprecedented time of police-related complaints and bureau scrutiny. Portland City Council has referred a measure to the November ballot asking residents to ditch the agency and appoint a newer model championed by Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. Avalos argues that this newer model could take over 2 years to fully implement, even if the measure passes, and that current hearings on appeals and complaints are already overloaded, with an extended backlog of a year or more. In light of these resignations, Avalos said, quote, "We need to fill these seats because we still have a job to do." A black man was asphyxiated by police after a hood was put on him in March. News of the police killing of Daniel Prude in Rochester, New York, broke yesterday in a press conference from his family. His death occurred at the hands of police back in March. A lawyer for his family shared police body camera footage of the situation with press outlets. According to his brother Joe, Prude was experiencing a mental health crisis at the time and was running outside naked when he called the police. When police arrived on the scene, Prude cooperated with them, laying on the ground with his hands behind his back. Police put a so-called spit hood on him, which is designed to keep people from spitting or biting police officers and spreading any sort of pathogen. Even with the hood on, police knelt on Prude's back until he stopped moving, at which point they noticed he had vomited water on the ground from inside the hood. Police then called for CPR and Prude was taken to a local hospital. He was declared brain dead on arrival and died a few days later. Prude was 41 years old. 7 officers involved in his death have now been suspended. According to Rochester Police, an internal investigation is ongoing. City Council members and the community at large are pushing for the officers to be fired and arrested. Daniel Prude's brother Joe calls the death, quote, "cold-blooded murder." The police killing is also being investigated by New York Attorney General Letitia James, who was unable to comment as the investigation is ongoing. In the Washington Post database of police killings since 2015, nearly a quarter of all police shooting victims showed signs of mental illness. President Trump issued a memo on Wednesday that instructed the Justice Department to label certain cities as anarchist jurisdictions, including Seattle, New York City, and Portland. Once the list is created, Trump has instructed that these cities be deprived funding to the maximum extent of the law. These so-called anarchist jurisdictions have not been singled out on a clear legal basis, but rather are united by their reluctance to use aggressive policing tactics to suppress protests. As Ian Millhiser writes for Vox, quote, "A city might end up on the list because the Trump administration thinks that it, quote, disempowers or defunds police departments, or because the administration believes that the city, quote, unreasonably refuses to accept offers of law enforcement assistance from the federal government," end quote. It is worth noting that the White House does not control funding for individual states or cities. Congress does. There are rules when it comes to putting conditions on federal funding, like that the rule has to be unambiguous and be related to the funding Congress would keep from the state. Additionally, the 10th Amendment to the Constitution gives any powers that are not outlined in the Constitution to the states. This created a doctrine of anti-commandeering, according to the Supreme Court, which means the federal government generally can't give direct orders to state or local officials. These cities are known to be very democratic as well, which likely motivates the decision to single them out. Critics like Elliot Hannon at Slate have pointed out that the move is likely aimed at sowing further division between liberal cities and more rural areas where Trump finds his base. Washington Governor Jay Inslee called the memo illegal and a sham in a release. He wrote, quote, "It is just the latest baseless, petty, and divisive move by President Trump to distract from his abject failure to protect Americans from COVID-19. With more than 185,000 lives lost on his watch, we won't forget. The president cannot and will not defund us. He is not a dictator, and laws still apply to him." Active COVID-19 workplace outbreaks are down this week, according to the Oregon Health Authority, with 73 remaining as of Friday. OHA reported a decline of 14 active outbreaks from last week, adding to the total number of resolved workplace outbreaks, which now sums to 114. Of the remaining active cases, the outbreak at the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution remains the largest, with 284 coronavirus cases directly linked to the center since the outbreak was first identified on June 8th. Numbers are also still on the rise at outbreaks identified at the Snake River Correctional Institution and in the Hermiston-based food processing plants Lamb Weston and Shearer's Foods. Health officials determine a workplace outbreak in instances where five or more employees become infected at an establishment employing at least 30 workers. An outbreak remains active if a case has been identified within the past 28 days, with case counts involving everyone who can be traced back to the source, including personal contacts outside the workplace. The largest outbreaks reported are resolved in Newport, where Pacific Seafood had 187 confirmed cases, in the Oregon State Penitentiary, where 185 cases were documented. Neither has had an additional infection since late July. Oregon numbers for positive COVID tests and infections are also on the decline, with the last week of August showing drops of positive testing by nearly 5% and drops in infection rates by 8.6%. On Thursday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 274 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19 and 3 new deaths. That brings the total number of cases in the state to 27,336 and the death toll to 470 lost due to coronavirus. Nationally, the U.S. reported 33,000 new cases today and 1,076 new deaths. Globally, the coronavirus has infected over 26 million people and over 860,000 people have died. Nationally, advocacy groups reported more than 2,000 hate incidents against Asian Americans over a three-month span at the start of the pandemic. The stigma against Asian Americans has persisted, seen in how some elected officials characterize the coronavirus. Mike Moen brings us this story from Minnesota.
More than a dozen Minnesota organizations are renewing concerns over language being used to describe the coronavirus. They're calling on elected leaders who either use offensive terms or embrace them to reverse course and condemn the rhetoric. This week, the Coalition of Asian American Leaders issued a statement on behalf of 17 other Minnesota groups. They took issue with a recent interview involving state GOP chair Jennifer Carnahan, who wouldn't denounce President Donald Trump for using terms such as China virus or Kung flu. The coalition's Nick Kaur says they feel the rhetoric has fueled the hostility Asian Americans have reported experiencing since the start of the pandemic.
The language that our leaders use have an impact on our communities, and they have an impact on how other people feel about specific issues.
Carnahan, who is Asian American, defended her stance on the president's use of the terms. She accused the organizations of using public pressure to conform to their viewpoint. The state Human Rights Department hasn't released specific numbers of reported hate incidents against Asian Americans, but has acknowledged hearing of many instances of various forms of aggression. Kaur says it's time for all elected leaders to strongly condemn the language so that Asian Americans and their communities can no longer feel scared.
It makes people more fearful to really just be able to live out their daily lives. Fearful to go outside, fearful to go to the grocery store.
Back in April, the state Human Rights Department launched a helpline to report discrimination incidents resulting from the pandemic. Kaur's group and other organizations have been working with the state to get people to report such incidents. But he says sometimes the information is too vague, limiting any follow-up work. He says that's why it's important for witnesses to speak up, which will aid investigators. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
New research shows a strong correlation between vaping and catching coronavirus. Diane Bernard brings us this story from Virginia.
Vaping and cigarette smoking are significant risk factors for COVID-19, according to new research from Stanford University. And this month, a Henrico County, Virginia-based program for parents and teens will present important findings from the study. The research surveyed youth between 13 and 24 years old. It reveals that those who vape regularly tested positive for COVID-19 five times more likely than those who never used e-cigarettes, according to Terrell Pollard with Henrico Too Smart to Start, an education nonprofit that will be holding the presentation. He says young people need to know how dangerous vaping is, especially now.
Initially, electronic cigarettes were marketed as a healthy option. And so by the time it was discovered that it wasn't, by that time, a lot of youth were hooked. And so people who vape are more susceptible to catch COVID-19. And once they caught COVID-19, then recovering is harder if they've been vaping.
Too Smart to Start will partner with the Virginia Department of Health, the American Heart Association, and the Henrico School System for the program, which will be held the third week of September. For more information, go to Henrico Too Smart to Start's Facebook page. The organization continually holds workshops to educate youth and their parents about health issues surrounding vaping and other drugs. Henrico County High School student Ahmed Smith attended a session in the spring. He said it raised his awareness about the serious side effects from the habit.
When I learned about the lung problems that were coming for the company of vapes, it really concerned me. When people started getting like their lungs infected and they started going to the hospital, and it's like crazy, people are still advertising jewels and vapes when people are in the hospital fighting for their lives because of their products.
Research shows that 3,500 youth start vaping every single day in the United States. In addition to causing lung and heart problems, the level of nicotine in e-cigarettes also is dangerous for young people because it can harm the developing adolescent brain. For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Leslie Gregory from the nonprofit Right to Health US. We will be discussing her organization's campaign to have racism officially declared a public health crisis. Stick around at 6 for Rose City Native Radio, which features local and national Native issues and contemporary Native music. Tonight's weather, we will be seeing clear skies and a low of 62 degrees. Tomorrow, the high will be 90 with sunny skies and a light breeze. Today in history, in 1971, Qatar gained its independence from Britain. It had previously been a protectorate of the UK since 1916. The quote of the day is from American poet E.E. Cummings, who died on this day in 1962. He wrote, quote, "To be nobody but yourself in a world which is doing its best night and day to make you everybody else means to fight the hardest battle which any human being can fight and never stop fighting." The Wilderness Act was signed into law 56 years ago today, and a coalition of groups is working to get more than 1 million acres of Owyhee Canyon lands in southeastern Oregon protected as wilderness. As Eric Tegedoff reports, the canyon lands are one of the largest intact landscapes in the West.
President Lyndon Johnson signed the Wilderness Act into law on this day in 1964. In Oregon, there's a push to use that law to protect the unique Owyhee Canyon lands as wilderness. The Malheur Community Empowerment for the Owyhee Act would designate more than 1 million acres as wilderness and protect more than 14 miles of the Owyhee River as wild and scenic. It also would protect grazing and land use laws. Liz Hamilton heads the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association and says the area is one of the largest intact landscapes left in the West.
It's a remarkable place for star viewing and for hunters, fishers, visitors, rafters, hikers, campers. This is a remarkable place that remains unprotected.
Oregon Senator Ron Wyden introduced the bill in November. Wyden brought together local ranchers, business owners, conservation groups, and others to help craft the bill. Hamilton says we need to take care of places like the Owyhee Canyonlands so we can take care of ourselves.
One of the things we've learned from this COVID experience that we're all in together is how much we need to get outdoors and how much we need to recharge ourselves in these special places.
About 500,000 acres of the Owyhee landscape across the border in Idaho already is designated wilderness. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Former Vice President Joe Biden is calling on President Trump to prioritize a safe return to in-person learning for students. With that story and more, it's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
You know, we've had broadband issues. We've had feeding our children issues, childcare issues.
Dr. Jan Mangrum, who's running for North Carolina state superintendent, joined Dr. Jill Biden, the former second lady, with parents and educators on a virtual panel yesterday, what back to school means in a pandemic.
You're looking at all those same problems, but through the lens of, you know, a computer most of the time.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, says it won't reimburse states for PPE, personal protective equipment, in non-emergency settings. Schools, courthouses, and public housing must classify it as simply, quote, increased operating costs. Former Vice President Joe Biden wants President Trump to prioritize helping American schools safely integrate in-person learning.
We need emergency support funding for our schools, and we need it now. So, President, that's your job. That's your job. That's what you should be focused on now, getting our kids back to school safely, not whipping up fear and division.
Biden's in Kenosha, Wisconsin today, where police shot Jacob Blake 7 times. This comes 2 days after President Trump's visit. New polls show Trump got a modest boost after the RNC convention. Overall, Biden is still ahead. His monthly August fundraising, a whopping $364 million, almost doubled the last presidential record set by Barack Obama in 2008, seemingly bolstered by his VP pick, Senator Kamala Harris. One brighter spot for Trump, Biden's lead in Pennsylvania dropped 9 points in the most recent Monmouth University poll. Still, he's 4 points ahead in that battleground state.
If we don't get a little relief in being able to count these, open the envelopes and count these ballots, I'm afraid that we might take a few days after election before we're going to be able to declare a winner.
Gene DiGirolamo, commissioner of the state's fourth largest county, says it was challenging to process 78,000 mail-in ballots in the primary. They estimate at least double that in November. Many states allow some processing of absentee ballots to begin before Election Day, but not Pennsylvania. DiGirolamo says state legislators could help.
I've lived here all my life in Bucks County in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is going to be one of a handful of states that's going to decide this election.
Election experts caution the public to expect delays because an accurate count of mail-in ballots this year will likely take more than a few days. The election night tally could easily be skewed by which party voted more in person versus by mail. Drew McCoy is with Decision Desk HQ, an election reporting service.
We're trying to explain to people this is not nefarious. This is just the nature of how states work.
And the Presidential Debate Commission announced this fall's moderators, none from the wish list Rudy Giuliani sent on Trump's behalf. Though Fox News' Chris Wallace gets the first debate, then C-SPAN's Steve Scully and NBC's Kristen Welker. USA Today's Susan Page will moderate the vice presidential debate. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Federal immigration authorities want to start collecting biometric data, such as retina scans and DNA, from immigrants and some of their family members. Civil rights groups are pushing back. Suzanne Potter has more.
In the near future, immigrants applying for a green card, visa, or work authorization could have to submit to iris scans, voice prints, and even DNA collection under a plan expected to be released this week by the Department of Homeland Security. This is in addition to the fingerprints already collected. Andrea Flores with the ACLU says the plan is overbroad and unnecessary.
How are they storing this data? Why do they need this data? They already collect biometric information, like fingerprints. Why are they collecting DNA? That seems incredibly invasive.
American citizens also may have to undergo the scans if they sponsor a family member to come here. DHS Secretary Ken Cuccinelli said the program is necessary to prevent immigration fraud and speed up identifications. The Trump administration already has begun collecting DNA swabs from migrants at the border. Flores says this is part of a larger effort to use extreme vetting to make life difficult for millions of people who go through the immigration system each year.
They're making it very costly and personally invasive for them to go through the immigration process. So they're really just trying to create new barriers for immigrants.
Civil rights advocates are urging Congress to demand answers on how long the data will be kept and whether it will be shared with law enforcement agencies aside from ICE and the Border Patrol. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A billion-dollar cleanup effort of Wisconsin's Lower Fox River is being celebrated by Wisconsin tribes and state officials. It was one of the most ambitious projects in the nation to take on contaminated sediments. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Wisconsin tribes, along with state and federal officials, are hailing the completion of a more than $1 billion cleanup on contaminated sediments in the state's Lower Fox River. The cleanup's considered one of the largest and most expensive in the nation. Danielle Kading has more.
The 17-year-long effort included 39 miles of the Lower Fox River in Green Bay, where paper mills lined the waterfront. Companies made coated paper that contained man-made chemicals known as PCBs, releasing them into the river from the mid-1950s to 1971. The chemicals were later banned because they don't break down easily in the environment and cause harmful health effects for humans, fish, and wildlife. Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Secretary Preston Cole says the cleanup removed 6.5 million cubic yards of contaminated sediments.
There's still a lot more work to do.
State, federal, and tribal partners have reached agreements with polluters to fund restoration of fish and wildlife habitat that was damaged. Oneida Nation Chairman Tahasi Hill says their ancestors once used the Lower Fox River for sustenance and travel.
Soon we'll be able to catch and eat clean, safe fish from the Lower Fox River and waters within the Oneida Reservation.
Gary Bisaw with the Menominee Tribe says restoration efforts include planting wild rice and improving brook trout habitat on the tribe's reservation.
Let us hope the lessons learned regarding the health of our beautiful environment do not send us down this path ever again.
Two paper companies will continue long-term monitoring within the river. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
The Gila River Indian community and the Navajo Nation announced Wednesday they joined U.S. Census litigation. The lawsuit seeks to require the Census Bureau to continue operations through October 31st. The deadline was shortened to September 30th by the Trump administration. The tribes say the deadline is rushed and threatens an undercount of their communities. COVID-19 has disrupted census activities, including in-person visits. Both tribes continue to have COVID-19 orders in place. The tribes say they rely on census data for the allocation of critical funding for programs and services such as education, housing, and health care. The lawsuit is in U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. Other plaintiffs include city and county governments and nonprofits. Meanwhile, the tribes are working to keep census momentum going. The Navajo Nation has proclaimed September as Census Month on the reservation, urging residents to complete their forms. The Yurok tribe in California began offering COVID-19 testing Wednesday at its Redwood Hotel Casino parking lot. Tests will be offered every Wednesday through the month of September. The tribe's collaborating with a county to provide the service, which is available to tribal and non-tribal residents for those not experiencing symptoms. People showing signs of COVID-19 are being asked to seek a test through their primary health care provider. The tribal council is encouraging all residents to take part in the drive-up testing in an effort to protect the community, especially as neighboring areas are seeing increases in COVID-19 infections. As of Wednesday, there have been no confirmed COVID-19 cases on the reservation. The tribe declared a state of emergency in March and has a number of COVID-19 measures in place. The reservation is currently closed to the public. The Federal Communication Commission Spectrum Priority filing window for tribes closed Wednesday. More than 400 applications were received for licenses for mid-band spectrum to cover rural areas. The FCC will begin reviewing applications. Any remaining unsigned licenses will be up for auction, which is expected to begin early next year. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade and Nat Moon. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, Eric Tegadoff, Mike Moen, and Diane Bernard. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's The Gap, talk radio devoted to bridging the generational divide. At 10, it's Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health, which brings you personal experiences of madness from beyond conventional perspectives and mainstream treatments. At 10:30, it's Film at 11. After a few brief reviews of current releases, host Doug Holmes discusses the BFI Film Classics book On the Birds by Camille Paglia, followed by commentaries on The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, the documentary Honeyland, and The Act of Killing. Then at 11, it's Pacific Underground, the show by and for the Asian and Pacific Islander community. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Up next is KBOO News In Depth. Today we are speaking with Leslie Gregory, the director of the nonprofit Right to Health US. The organization is part of an effort to declare racism as a public health crisis. Stay with us.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Coming up now is an interview with Leslie Gregory. Leslie is the founder of Right to Health, a group dedicated to creating a network committed to alleviating the effects of racism. Leslie is a physician's assistant, Navy vet, and social justice activist who studies the health impacts of racism with a clinical and public health lens. She sat down with KBOO's Althea Billings to discuss the importance of intersectionality in mediation work, why claiming to be colorblind erases people's experiences, and how being an anti-racist is an act of daily practice.
My name is Leslie Gregory, and I'm a physician assistant since 2000. And I started my nonprofit in 2006, which was initially started about health disparities and heart disease, which is kind of the focus of my practice, and then shifted into looking for the cause of it as my practice progressed, as my experience progressed in terms of looking for causes instead of just kind of Band-Aid approach to health problems. And so we've been doing it since then. I have been fighting the health effects of racism for a very long time. Started with my mom, who started a mobile unit back in my hometown in Ohio, and that's kind of what mentored me into medicine in the first place.
Yeah, and so your organization, Right to Health US, has a campaign to get racism declared a public health crisis. The CDC has certain parameters for determining what falls into a health crisis, and you say that racism meets those guidelines. Can you walk me through some of that?
Sure. So the guidelines are very clear, and we can see how they are actually being played out right now in the health crisis of the virus. And so these four criteria, which, you know, I should mention, are not just viral. They're not just, you know, associated with pathogens. They are conditions when, you know, when these are met, constitute a health crisis. So, for instance, the virus certainly qualifies, but so did some of the other health crises in the past, like HIV. So the four criteria are, first, that it's a burden on society, whether that's financial or in life or in, you know, whatever type of terms, it's a burden. The other is that this burden is disproportionately shared by a certain segment of the population. So for instance, pregnant women or, you know, people who smoke or drivers, you know, like seatbelt and all the car crashes that were happening before seatbelts were instituted. The third is that current measures are insufficient, meaning it's declared a crisis because what we started trying wasn't working. So current measures are insufficient. And then the fourth is that there's evidence that upstream change will make a difference. In other words, you know, local efforts, clinical efforts in the clinic, you know what I mean? You know, band-aid approaches are not working. That means it's typically institutional. And that's when we get our national health services like CDC, NIH, Surgeon General, these sort of institutional changes are brought in and called in. And so that's why, for instance, CDC has put, you know, this huge effort into creating vaccine, you know, things like that. So those are the four criteria. And once they're met, and again, these criteria are in place for a reason, so that emotion, politics, you know, bias, et cetera, should be sort of programmed out. Once you set these criteria, it's no longer a matter of political will or opinion or, you know, this sort of thing. It's supposed to be clinical. Once those things are met, then the dominoes fall and, you know, these programs are set into place, budget is freed up, access, et cetera. And it's so interesting that the virus is happening at this time because it does show us exactly what a public health crisis calls for. And as you can see, you know, these sort of protocols have been instituted.
Right, it's not in the abstract. What are some examples exactly. of how race factors into health?
And this is another one of those things that's been very well documented and which puts clinicians like myself into this sort of baffling role because, for instance, we know, at least I see, you know, every day the impacts of racism for everyone. And I think that's the difference between the protocol that I proposed and others that have also tried to address racism. One of the things we see is an increased level of just sort of stress response, whether it's increased blood pressure or difficulty controlling behaviors. Often that is the way it manifests for some people, is just, you know, compulsive behaviors. What we call coping mechanisms, but often adapt into maladaptive coping mechanisms. So for instance, a person who will smoke or drink initially may start out with that behavior as a coping mechanism. You know, you pick up a cigarette, it gives you that break, right? You just take it, you know, take the cigarette out on the back porch or whatever, and you get away, right? Smoke break. That's how that kind of came about. And of course, in the moment, it feels relaxing. You take that smoke break and you feel like, I can go back to working. I can go back to whatever stressful job or situation I'm in. Same with alcohol. You take this drink and initially it feels, you know, euphoric. It lets you separate from the stress. But over time, those repetitive behaviors, you know, right? Obviously, they lead to habituation, addiction, the inability to stop, et cetera. So that's one of the ways that stress, and again, racism is sort of this kind of ongoing low-level stress, may manifest in your life. It's through these kinds of behaviors. Sometimes it's overeating. You know, sometimes it's just getting anger out. It can be abusive behaviors. You know, we see these sorts of things right now during the virus where people are locked in. And often that's what racism does. It isolates people. And so just like the virus is doing that, and we're seeing the stress of isolation, imagine an entire culture being marginalized in this way and isolated and having rights taken away and having excluded from services, jobs, you know, that kind of thing. And that's what racism does. It alienates people, and race itself becomes this predetermining factor, which if you look at the actual science behind it, there really is no biologic correlate to race. It is entirely cultural in the perception of it. You know, skin color does not determine, you know, very much more than just skin color. And yet, because it's easily identifiable, it becomes this other determining factor where people look at skin color and then make all these other assumptions, right? There's, you know, so many other things attached to that that are not appropriate, that may be visually simple to draw, but in actuality are mistaken And so that's another reason that racism is directly associated with stress and these kinds of behaviors, because it's a misnomer. It's a mistake. It's an easily made visual misperception that allows us to ascribe other characteristics and factors to what is in actuality nothing more than a change in melanin. So you can see how the brain would see this and think simply on the surface, oh, there's this big difference. But deep inside, there's an awareness that there really is no difference. And here I am alienating this group of people. And so that's how I believe racism affects not just people of color, but also dominant culture. There is a misperception that deeply, deeply offends the psyche.
Yeah, and it's an interesting distinction to make. I think sometimes people get tripped up on the idea that race is a social construct, which means that it is society that gives it meaning. But as I was looking at things from your organization, Right to Health US, it has a real impact on public health, and it's been studied already with these sort of code words like social determinants of health. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, sure. And I think this is, again, one of those things that's associated with stress. We are trying to find other ways to describe, study, manage, educate around racism. We're trying to find other ways to do that that are less triggering, which we understand that. You know, who wouldn't understand that? We're trying to find other ways to describe it because we know, and this is, you know, another human phenomenon, after you use a word multiple times, it's going to become either pejorative, or it becomes colloquial, or it gets triggering, or you've heard it so many times that it no longer has the initial meaning. And this is what has happened. As soon as you start using racism over and over and over, it becomes triggering, particularly to dominant culture. So this is why we start to use other words like social determinants of health, which, you know, in fact, do include other things. It, you know, social determinants include, you know, other things, which are, you know, environmental, you know, dietary, all these other things. But almost all these other things can be associated, again, to the institution of racism, right? And that's the issue. It's an institutional issue. Back in the day when I was growing up, racism initially just sort of meant that thing that, you know, white people do that is harmful. You know, calling one person a bad name. You know, that's racist. That's racism. And over time, again, as our perceptions and descriptive terms have changed, it now becomes this institutional issue. And so it is a system of granting worth or withholding worth based on skin color. So things have changed over time, and that has to happen. You know, it has to happen. After we use words so many times, you know, the dictionary is a living document. It is a changing and evolving. So this is what happens. And once you use a word like, or, you know, not even a word, a phrase, for instance, Black Lives Matter, for instance, you know, these are all phrases that have changed over time, and that's what's happening to words. And when we start using these words over and over, they start triggering people, and before you know it, racism itself, the word, the sound, the repetitive syllables themselves can create physical responses from people. So, you know, when, as soon as you say a word, people begin to get triggered. And so using these, you know, social determinants, et cetera, becomes another way of discussing something, hopefully without that triggering. Now, what we know, of course, particularly living here, is that hasn't happened. You know, people are still being quite triggered by these words, and pretty soon it becomes code for racism. So that's another way that stress of all groups can be increased by this. And very often it becomes, in our culture, it becomes this sort of white and black thing, but we have to remember that the rainbow that is the United States has varying degrees of marginalization based on skin tone, even within and out groups, right? So, and, you know, again, it becomes this sort of issue of colorism. And these are all very subtle you know, differences. There may be a very subtle difference between racism as experienced by, for instance, a Vietnamese individual or a Filipino individual, and that was an issue. So, like I said, it, you know, depending on what in-group you're discussing and what out-group you're discussing, these issues of what I call othering can be, you know, they're raised. They become an issue.
In the realm of public health, how does a more colorblind, quote-unquote, mentality limit or damage meaningful treatment of issues?
So that is a really big, important piece, because particularly in areas like Portland, where there are fewer people of color, there's less diversity than more, people like to use that phrase and say, well, you know, I just don't see color. And so this colorblind approach really can be more damaging in the process of trying to work with communities of color, because what it literally feels like in that moment, and again, this can be fairly bizarre to people who are not living it, is it means you don't see me. And that means that you're not accepting those experiences that I'm trying to tell you about, or that I am expressing, whether it's to you or to the general population or to my boss or to people who I'm trying to get to change behavior, as this sort of denial. You know, it's a denial. I don't see color. Well, that means you don't see the effects that I'm trying to explain to you in the moment. That means you don't acknowledge the very damage that I'm seeking to repair. And the point is, whether or not you see it, it's affecting you. So whether or not you accept it, you have a certain level of privilege. And again, privilege is another one of those words, like I said, that starts to become triggering, has become colloquial, and becomes jargon. Eventually, you can use that as a part of dominant culture to say, okay, they said I have privilege. They said I am racist. They said, when I don't see color, which also means I don't see my privilege, right? And so that, again, creates this barrier to acceptance of my experience. And that's how people who say, you know, I don't see color, it feels like what you're really trying to say is you don't see the issue I'm trying to raise in the moment. And so you're able, if you say you don't see color, you're able to deny my experience. And that's not acceptable.
Yeah, I also understand that your organization has been called in for some mediation work. Can you tell me about that?
I think the biggest experience I've ever gotten in mediation is sitting in a clinic working with patients, because, you know, very often a patient will come in who's diabetic and I'll say, look, before we address your diet, before we address your glucose and your weight and the things associated with diabetes, you know, I need to see what you're eating. And so an assessment is the first step. And then we negotiate from where a patient is to where a patient needs to be. And that's mediation, right? That's negotiation. And so that's what I try to approach with working with an anti-racist health-centered campaign, not just with health, quote, disparities, so people are thinking, okay, minority populations are at higher risk for systemic disease, and of course that's true. But in a racist culture, and again, we're not talking about individual races, we're talking about institutions, we're talking about what's in the water. Right, where if you look at our country as a soup, the broth itself is racism. And so when you're trying to go negotiate through a culture of othering, marginalization, abuse, etc., you really have to approach it in that way. And so that's how we look at it. We do assessments first. We say, okay, where are we? As a part of the health negotiation, if you will, we're looking at first, where are you? And then we negotiate through, where do we want to get? And that's how negotiation in health is accomplished. And so we are hoping to have more opportunities to negotiate from a health perspective, the kind of marginalization, for instance, the violence we're seeing on the street. This is in everyone's best interest to address, not just those communities that are particularly in the crosshairs in the moment. And that's probably familiar to your listeners as the all boats rise phenomenon. And that's the other thing that we, you know, rely heavily on, the understanding that if you address these issues for communities of color, then the benefits to all of society vastly outweigh the cost.
In doing this work, are there misconceptions that you encounter when you try to advocate for racism as a public health crisis?
There are lots of obstacles. And I think the biggest one is denial. And again, that is a coping mechanism that we're very familiar with. It is not isolated to any culture. This is not a puzzle. This is a very common coping mechanism that individuals, cultures, societies adapt. It's a way of, if you can think of a drowning person under stress, right? That's the ultimate of stress. You're drowning, you feel your life is at risk. And so you reach out for whatever you can that seems to be buoyant in that moment. That's a coping mechanism. It doesn't matter what it is. Like we talked about, a person who's under a great deal of stress may light that cigarette up in the moment. It may feel like a great buoy, right? Something I can hold on to that just keeps me up, keeps my nose out of the water for 5 minutes before I go back into the fray, you know. That is a misperception that happens all the time. If I can just do something right now to make me feel better. And so denial is a big part of that. I can't deal with all the rest of it right now. I just want to feel better for this moment. And so that's what ends up happening. It's been looking big picture. When you're under stress, you just grab that first, whatever it is, misperception, bad habit, you know, thought error. And I think at the end of the day, that's what racism is. It's a thought error, and it's reinforced by institutions, and that's how it's taken out of that individual realm, and it becomes institutional. When you sit at the bus stop and all the buses going by have only white people on them, when you go to school and are learning and all the books have only white people represented in your social media, your educational media, your health-centered media, all these things create an illusion. And I think that's the biggest piece. It allows us to deny that these things are happening. And that's, you know, it's fairly complex when you think about it. And when you're asking someone under duress to try and peel that layer back, it's very difficult to do that. So I think that's one of the other obstacles we've had to calling racism a public health crisis, because, you know, there's a great meme right now going around, and it is that privilege is that idea that if it's not my problem, it's not a problem. And so I think that's one of the biggest obstacles we have right now, is to get people to understand that just because you have the privilege of denial of this issue doesn't mean it's not an issue. And I think that's one of the biggest obstacles. I think the other obstacle is that once you declare something a crisis, a public health crisis, then again, that funding mobilizes, the dominoes fall, and people are terrified with this sort of, okay, then what? Am I gonna lose my privilege? Does that mean it's gonna cost me something? And again, we can see what's happening with the virus. You know, people with privilege are having those privileges taken away. And that's one of the things we're seeing. They're, you know, we're seeing people resist the loss of privilege.
Leslie, if our listeners are interested in supporting your work, how can they do that?
Well, there's lots of different ways. We've tried to make it pretty easy, but especially in this time where economic concerns, you know, sort of pretty much hit everybody, we're making it really, really easy to help. First, there's a moveon.org petition. Won't cost you anything. You can go to moveon.org and type in racism and public health, and we'll come up. We're asking folks to go ahead and sign it, send it over to your email list and contacts and social media, and, you know, however you can share it, because we're really trying to get that number up over 100,000, at which point there's sort of a soft mandate for the target of the campaign to go ahead and contact, reach out, make a statement, hit us up, you know, okay, I heard you've been calling me out. What do you want? You know, this sort of thing. The other way you can do it is you can go to Amazon Smile. That's a giving campaign through Amazon where if you, whatever purchases you make, you can lock it into your computer, Amazon Smile. So whenever you go to Amazon, you can choose Right to Health, Inc. as your charity so that whenever you buy something at Amazon, you know, just a tiny little bit, like I said, it won't cost you anything. A little bit of it will donate to the nonprofit. So that's another way you can do it. You can make a donation, and that's on the righttohealthus.org website. You can, you know, just make a flat out donation. Another way that you can do it, though, is to just very simply be aware of bias in your own life. And that can take some help, and that's another part of what we do. We help groups, individuals, you know, other institutions, committees, commissions, etc. We help them understand what it looks like to have an anti-racist approach. And that's, it's not enough to say I'm not a racist. You have to be actively anti-racist. And so, you know, that's another way that people can help is by approaching and doing that self-assessment when you walk down the street and you have sort of a quick reaction to something, you know, whether it's to clutch that purse in the elevator when a black person's on it, or that little bit of aversion to, you know, listening to a word or a sound or a facial expression or things like that. Do some personal self-assessment. And there are lots of excellent tools online. You know, a lot of people have done a lot of excellent work in this regard, just helping people to recognize the signs of othering in the individual. And you can do, you know, that will be helpful as well. But a lot of it is just plain old have compassion. Look at yourself and understand your privilege. And that's the other thing I tell people is recognize and utilize your privilege. And it may be scary. Very often it's scary. And that's the other thing. It's about courage. It's about what do you want your world to look like? How do you want to show up in this world? And that can be tough for some people. That can be real tough. It calls for people to reassess their self-image. You know, instead of thinking to yourself, I'm not a racist, you can stop and think to yourself, but am I an anti-racist? Right? You can see the subtle difference there. But there are lots of ways you can help. And, you know, a brilliant anti-racist activist that I know once said, if you want to work on this, do you. Just do you with an anti-racist approach. And that means, you know, whatever it is that you do, if you're a quilter, you know, look around at your quilting group and say, hey, when was the last time we actually reached out to someone who doesn't look like us? If you're a religious person, you know, how about go to that church on the other side of town where, you know, maybe we can be a sister church, switch preachers for a Sunday or two, have an intervention with that group. Let's have an event. Let's partner. You know, reach out, because connection is the antidote for hate. And I think that's an important piece as well. Reach out. And the current vitriol and separating verbiage out of our leadership has been particularly unhelpful. So the way to fix that, to counter it with unity, counter it with reaching out, attempting to connect. I think that's another way people can help. Just look around, standing in that line at the grocery. You know, did that person overlook the person of color in front of you? Then speak up and say, hey, he or she was here first. You know, just little acts of kindness, little acts of inclusion every day are presented to us if we only look, if we only try to find them. You know, a smile. Gee, I noticed you're the only person sitting here alone. Can I sit by you? Gee, you know, that kind of thing. It's as simple as that, and it's as big as that.
Right, not asking people to take on the world on their own. Is there anything
exactly
like,
right.
Yeah. Is there anything else that we should cover before we wrap up?
I think one thing that I would ask for people to do is to be just a little more sensitive in terms of looking around and a little less sensitive in terms of getting one's feelings hurt. Sensitive is such a, it's an interesting word. And very often people of color have been accused of being overly sensitive. Well, I didn't mean it that way. You just took it, you know, you're oversensitive. I didn't mean it that way. What I would ask people to do in their daily lives is to be a little more sensitive with regard to other and a little less sensitive with regard to self. In other words, you know, think about someone else's feelings before you speak and be a little less ready to be triggered by someone else's words to you. So if someone says something like, you know, wow, that hurt my feeling, you can be that person who says, okay, let me look at what it was that hurt your feelings so that I can do better. Not have that reflex of, no, I didn't. You see, it's a very small step. But if we can begin to de-escalate ourselves, then I think the hope for de-escalating our world increases.
That was Leslie Gregory of Right to Health speaking with KABU's Althea Billings.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open